In chapter 6, verse 4, we're given our first clue. Here's the clue. It says, the Jewish Passover feast was near. Okay? So Jesus is acting near the Jewish Passover feast. And as with all the other events and all the other articles the whole way through the gospel, he's going to use this particular event. You're going to love this, I think. He's going to use this particular event to say something about himself. So the first question we need to ask, if we're swimming into the deep end, we're given the clue here. It takes near the Passover. You'll also give clues. Oh, it takes near the tabernacle. It takes near the Sabbath. Okay? First question we need to ask is what? He's given us the clue. It takes near the Passover. What's the first question we should ask?
What's the Passover?
What's the Passover? Absolutely. And then to get our answer, what are we going to do?
Go to the internet.
Go to the internets. That's right. The tubes that go everywhere and they'll send us the answers. Okay? So, what was the Passover? See if you can do this. What was the Passover? The greatest feast of the Jewish calendar happened every year in the spring. What else do you know about it? What did it celebrate?
Come on.
Something about
the it's tied that's, into that for Christians, yeah. but
go back.
Yep.
Before
after when Moses led all the people out.
Yes. Right. It's a story about Moses. The Passover is a story about Moses. Actually, all the feasts and the festivals in one way or another about this, because it was the central thing for Israel's life. Okay, but it's a story about Moses. How he led the people out of captivity. Right? Led them away from Egypt, out of the freedom of their slavery, or into the freedom of, out of their slavery and into their freedom. Now, what were some of the specifics of that great event? After he escapes from Egypt, then what happens?
They spend the time in the desert.
Before then, even.
They cross the sea.
They go through the Red Sea, yes. And then they end up in the desert. And what happens when they end up out in the desert?
Complain.
Yes, they grumble.
The law.
They grumble. Before then, even before the law, they grumble because they're hungry.
Oh, bread and manna.
Bread and manna. Give us the bread and manna. Okay, so already then we've got this story of the Passover in our mind, and we think to ourselves, projecting into the story a little bit, maybe this story is going to be about Jesus saying that he's going to be the deliverer. He's the one that gives us the bread we need. Okay. So, just so happens, in this particular instance, to add light into the story, Jesus does not just one sign, but he does two signs. Two signs near the Passover. And maybe they'll help to illustrate even more what he's doing. Let's read from chapter 6, the next line, verse 5. When Jesus looked up, saw a great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for all these people to eat?" He asked this only to test them, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. He already knew what he was going to do. He's using this for something. Philip answered him, 8 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each one to have a bite." And other of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up, "Here is a boy with 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish, but how far will they go among so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." There was plenty of grass in that place, and the men sat down, about 5,000 of them. Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed to those who were seated as much as they wanted, and he did the same with the fish. When they had all had enough, he gathered enough to eat. He said to the disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted." So they gathered with them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. After the people saw the miraculous sign that Jesus did, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who has come into the world." Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to the mountain by himself. So, it's Passover. Everybody's thinking about Moses and the story of Moses. And then Jesus is on a mountain. And they come to him. And they are hungry. And so what does Jesus do for them? He gives them bread. Like who? Like who?
Moses.
Not like Moses.
Yeah, like Moses. And at the end, they gather up 12 basketfuls. What might Jesus be saying? That he's like Moses? Well, maybe there's more. Okay, so let's read what comes next. Let's read verse 16 then, okay? When the evening came, his disciples went down to the lake, where they got into a boat and set off across the lake for Capernaum. By now it was dark, and Jesus was not yet joined them. A strong wind was blowing, and the waters grew rough. When they had rowed 3.5 miles, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on the water, and they were terrified. But he said to them, "It's I, do not be afraid." Then they were willing to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading. The next day, the crowd that had stood on the opposite shore of the lake realized that only one boat had been there, and that Jesus had not entered it with the disciples, but they had gone away alone. Then some boats from Tiberias landed near the place where the people had eaten the bread after the Lord had given thanks. Once the crowd realized that neither Jesus nor his disciples were there, they got into the boats and went to Capernaum in search of Jesus. Okay. So after giving the bread, what's he do?
Ditches them.
He ditches them, yeah. Specifically, what does he do? He walks through the water. Like who? Like Moses at the Passover, what everybody's around celebrating right now. What was he saying? Was this just a neat trick? Jesus decided one day, guys, I know you're going to head across in the water, but I'd rather just walk it on the water. See, that's the thing. We read the miracles so often, and we're like, these are neat tricks about Jesus that he does, like walking across water, but maybe there are more. Maybe Jesus is saying something to us. Maybe he's trying to say something about him being like Moses, but even more. See, he's using these signs combined with the Passover event to reveal something about himself. He wants them to see that he too would be like Moses, providing the Passover for them, that he was going to lead them out of their captivity into something different. But as with every one of these events, he was going to ratchet things up even more. So he's going to say, "I'm like Moses, but I'm even more than Moses. I'm even greater. I'm even greater than Moses, because Moses gave you bread, but you still died. And the bread I'm about to give you is something even more," which is exactly what he now goes on to say to them. Look at what he explains it all at the end. Verse 25 to 51, a big, long section. Let's read the whole thing. When they found him on the other side of the lake, they asked him, "Rabbi, how did you get here?" Jesus answered, "I tell you the truth. You're looking for me, not because you saw miraculous signs, but because you ate the loaves and had your fill. Do not work for food that spoils, but for food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. On him, God the Father has placed the seal of approval." Then they asked him, "What must we do to do the works that God requires?" Jesus answered, "The work of God is this, to believe in the one he has sent." So they asked him, "What miraculous sign then will you give that we may see it and believe you? What will you do? Our forefathers ate the manna," see, they're thinking about the Passover feast right now, "in the desert. As it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat." And Jesus said to them, I tell you, here's where he's ratcheting things up now. He's taking the story of Moses, but now he's going to use it to say something even more about him. "I tell you the truth, it is not Moses who has given you the bread from heaven, but it is my Father who gave you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." "Sir," they said, "from now on, give us this bread," like Moses gave it to him. Then Jesus declared, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will never go hungry, and he who believes in me will never be thirsty. But as I told you, you have seen me, and you still do not believe. All that the Father gives me will come to me, and whoever comes to me I will never drive away, for I have come down from heaven, not to do my will, but to do the will of him who sent me. And this is the will of him who sent me, that I shall lose none of all that he has given me, but raise them up at the last day. For my Father's will is that everyone who looks to the Son and believes in him shall have eternal life, and I will raise him up at that day." At this, the Jews began to grumble, right, like all the rest of them, about him, because he said, "I am the bread that came down from heaven." They said, "Is this not Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How can he say now that I've come down from heaven?" "Stop grumbling among yourselves," Jesus answered. "No one can come to me unless the Father who has sent me draws him, and I will raise him up at the last day. It is written in the prophets, they will all be taught by God. Everyone who listens to the Father and learns from him comes to me. No one has seen the Father except the one who is from God. Only he has seen the Father. I tell you the truth, He who believes has everlasting life. Here it is again. I am the bread of life. Your forefathers ate manna in the desert, yet they died. So the event you're celebrating right now, those guys, they ate the bread in the desert, but they died. But here is the bread that comes down from heaven. He's ratcheting it up, which a man may eat and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. This bread is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world. Okay. It's foreshadowing. Now, there's a whole lot going on in there, right? There's a whole bunch of other things that Jesus is communicating to them as well. But at the core of it, he's taking this key event that they all knew about, the Passover, and he's using it to say something about himself. And then he's using these signs to help illustrate it, to help bring it to life even more. So that they can get, oh yeah, you're saying you're like Moses. But yet more, because the bread that Moses gave us, we still died from. But you're saying to us the bread that you're going to give, which is you, your very person. That's a bread that leads to life. Okay? And this is how the whole opening book works. All of these things work like this. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You see that? We'll see the tabernacles tomorrow. We'll dig into it. It's exactly the same. It works the same way. Okay, so back to the toolbox. Another toolbox. If you want to swim to the deep end, first of all, the more you understand specifically, not just about the long story, but specifically about the institutions and the festivals, the more you do, the more we'll understand what Jesus is saying about himself in each of the stories. And the second thing in John's Gospel, particularly, is don't just read the signs as neat stories that Jesus does, but read them as the illustrations. Jesus is trying to highlight something about himself. The whole Gospel is Jesus revealing himself so that we might believe, and all of these things are here to help us understand what Jesus is saying about himself. Any questions? We're just about finished. Got half a page left. No, a bit more than that. No? No questions?
So do you see similar like parallels set up like that in the other Gospels?
No. Not in the same way. Not at all. John really is drawing out a few stories to really highlight some things about Jesus. He's putting the stories together to help us see this. Okay. So then the Book of Signs ends down here with chapters 11 and 12. And the two chapters combine to kind of serve as the climax and the conclusion of the book. And without question, the Book of Signs is building towards this climax in chapter 11, where Jesus does his biggest sign. He raises Lazarus from the dead, which also serves as the biggest illustration to his biggest revelation. And his biggest revelation was, I am the resurrection and the life. Those two things are connected. Okay, so Jesus is going to raise Lazarus from the dead and make the announcement, I am the resurrection from the dead. It's an illustration for him. But you know that it kind of stands on its own. It's not connected to any particular festival or anything. It's like this story is just so important. It's just there on its own. Lazarus is going to be raised from the dead, and then Jesus is going to make the announcement, I am the resurrection. Okay?
Can you go back to that last slide just for a second?
Yeah.
I have a question.
Yes, go for it.
In all of these, then in these different ones that you've talked, well, church yesterday, you talked about the cleansing jars of the first one, and then you just talked about Passover.
Mm-hmm.
The other two, or the other few, like the Sabbath, for example, are the is the signs that follow, are they also like backing up?
Yeah.
Those ones are?
The one where they're indented, that's the sign that's connected to the institution, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They're all bridged together, all connected together that way. Okay, so chapter 11 forms a climax, and then chapter 12, the story begins to resolve itself as a denouement, as we say, and it's the story of Jesus being anointed by his good friend Mary. But what we'll need to see is that these chapters 11 and chapter 12, you finished on that slide there? Yeah, chapter 11 and chapter 12... we need to see as well is that these don't just resolve this book, but they also foreshadow the book of glory. We'll talk more about that in a little bit tomorrow. But the raising of Lazarus is particularly foreshadowing what? The resurrection of Jesus, yes. The anointing of Jesus by Mary, we'll read about the story tomorrow, is also foreshadowing something else. And we'll look at that later. Okay, so they're also, so they close off the first book, but they also build a bridge. They build a gap into the second book. Does that make sense? How that works? Okay. Now, let's dig into the second book. The second book is chiefly concerned about Jesus' death and resurrection. Yes?
Before you go into this second book, what is
denouement? Denouement? Yeah, that's like the French word that we use for the conclusion of a story or the resolving of a story. They call it the denouement of a story. So this story, right, is about, and we won't go into it with near the details of the other one because we just won't, you just don't need to. It makes more sense. It's just telling one story. And the book begins, as I say, in chapter 13 with Jesus washing the disciples' feet. That's how it starts off. And it's this beautiful picture of Jesus serving his disciples, but we're going to see on the last day of teaching, that it's also an opening picture of what the whole book of glory is going to be about. Right? That when Jesus washes the disciples' feet, it's like this foreshadowing saying, now Jesus is about to die on the cross where he will also serve the world. Right? So it's kind of introducing that whole thing. That okay with that? We'll deal with that more in the days ahead. And then from there, we have the next four chapters where Jesus is now specifically going to have one long speech. We call it the farewell discourse, where Jesus is going to prepare his disciples for his coming death and resurrection. And more than anything else, he tells them in this section that even though he's about to die, they're going to be okay. And we have to ask the question, why are they going to be okay? Jesus has just been with them for all these years. Why are they going to be okay? Well, that's what we'll deal with on the last day. And then he finally, after comforting them and teaching them about his leaving, then he ends with this big long prayer in chapter 17, where he prays for himself, and then he prays for the disciples, and then he prays for all the believers that are coming after him. And then after this, chapters 18 to 20 is when it all shakes down. Just like Jesus has been saying all along that it would, just like the Gospels have been foreshadowing that it would, his own people are about to take him outside of the vineyard and kill him. Remember that story from the last time I was with you? The parable of the wretched tenants. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. The thing is that John says in John chapter 1, and we'll come to this tomorrow, he says that the light shone in the darkness. That's what the book of signs is about, the light shining in the darkness. But the darkness did not overcome it. That's what the book of glory is about. Book of signs, light of Jesus shining into the darkness. Book of glory, seems like the darkness is about to overcome it. But then we discover, no, the darkness has not overcome it because Jesus, on the third day, is going to rise again. What we'll deal with on the last day of teaching. And it's here that the story of the gospel makes its real grand climax. Remember how I just said that the gospel is built around seven signs? Remember that? It's actually not. I said that it was built around seven signs, but it's not actually built around seven signs. It's actually built around eight signs, or maybe better put, it's built around seven signs plus one sign. The whole last book of glory is actually just one sign. It's the sign of Jesus rising from the dead. And the resurrection, foreshadowed in the resurrection would be Jesus' final greatest sign. Because this is where Jesus is going to reveal now to all of us what he intends to do for all of creation. To all people. To rise from the dead. He says he was the resurrection of the life. And when he comes bursting forth from the grave, it was a sign to everyone that it was all true. To a broken and dead world, he had come to bring life and life to the full, and the resurrection was the sign that he meant exactly, or that what he intended to do, he was exactly going to fulfill. It was a great sign to say, this is what I'm doing, right? So Jesus, in the opening book of signs, he steps into the darkness of the world and he performs all of these signs. And what he's doing is he's performing all these signs in a big picture, as he's looking around and he's seeing all of this brokenness everywhere he goes. This world is broken. Then, in the final book, Jesus is going to die. He's going to suffer the death and the reality of the brokenness of the world firsthand, but then he's going to rise again. It'll be the great sign saying to us all, this is what I intend. I intend to make all things new. It's a great sign. Seven. Seven plus one. Jesus' resurrection wasn't just about him rising from the grave. It was a sign, the first sign that a new world, a new creation was beginning. A new world that was no longer held down by death, and that he was the center of that new world. Never read the resurrection just like Jesus rising from the dead. Read it as a promise.
Does that correlate with the garden?
We'll come to that. We'll come to that in the next few days. So as we conclude today, and we're finished now, I want us to watch this little clip by this guy named Rob Bell, because he pulls together a lot of the things that we're talking about, but he also foreshadows some of the things that we're going to deal with in the next few days. And I think, this will just stand on its own, this little section of his teaching. Okay. I just want to make sure that I got...
Do you want to need the lights? We don't need them.
Okay, you ready?
Don't need them.
Okay, John does a very interesting thing. In John chapter 2, John talks about Jesus turning water into wine, and then he says this was his first sign. Then a little while later, in John 4, Jesus heals the official's son, and John says this was his second sign. And then, partway through, he uses the word sign, but he stops numbering them. He's like, I think it's 4 or 5, I'm not sure. If you actually count when Jesus does what John kind of categorizes as a sign, you end up with water into wine, 1, official son, 2, at the pool, 3, the turning the bread, 4, water, 5, walking on water, 5, heals a blind man, 6, and then in John 11, he raises a man from the dead, which is the 7th sign. And John, it's almost like they're like blinking lights, like, by the way, have you noticed that the raising of the dead is the 7th one? 7 in Jewish consciousness is a number most closely associated with what? Creation. Remember that for a good Jew, everything means something else. 7 would have been a number that would have jumped out. And the signs build. We start with wine, but by the 7th, man, we're raising a man from the dead. And so when Jesus is resurrected, that would be the 8th sign. Well, if 7 refers to the first week of creation, then what would an 8th sign be? The first day of a new creation. Wow. I actually, I talked about this somewhere else. And Mary doesn't recognize Jesus and thinks he's a gardener. That, if there ever, the actual Greek there is parentheses, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. It's a new creation. The old creation had a death problem. The new creation doesn't. The resurrection inaugurates a new creation. First 7 days are done. It's an 8th day. It's a Monday, but it's a different kind of Monday. Maybe you can say it this way. The story is about Jesus' resurrection beginning a new creation right here in the midst of this one. You got that from you, eh?
Yeah, totally. So See the links? Right. It's all building toward this eighth sign. First week has a death problem. The week to come doesn't. And so tomorrow, we're going to look at the book of signs. And the last day, we're going to look at the book of glory as we build toward the climax. Homework for tonight.